podcast is also brought to you by Green Regimen. Guys, you have to try their plant-based protein powder. It's amazing. So I'm not vegan, but I'm lactose intolerant, and I've tried a bunch of vegan powder. It's all gross to me. The beef-based kind aren't that much better, but this stuff is legit. My favorite combination is to add a scoop of their chocolate protein powder to PB Fit and a half cup of oats. It's like peanut butter cup cereal. It's amazing. I have it every single day. So go to my show notes, click on the link at checkout, put the promo code Noah. Yeah, shocker, it's my name. Put Noah for 10% off. There's free shipping for qualified orders. Do it, you won't regret it. Now let's get to the show. Hey everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Coffee Time Podcast with Noah Kinsey. I'm your host, Noah Kinsey, and this is the podcast that humanizes people. So today I have on special guest Jacqueline Davis. She is the mom in chief, founder, and CEO of the game company Clever Noodle, where they create educational games for elementary school kids. I think this is the first one, is on Kickstarter now. By the time this comes out, it'll be about 14 days left, but definitely check it out. It's absolutely amazing. We had a fantastic conversation about the state of education, you know, initially talking about some of the challenges, but then moving on to a plan of action and advancements in education to help kids with their literacy, which is sadly falling pretty behind. I was pretty surprised to hear the statistics of how many kids aren't reading at their grade level. Definitely can understand that. And with a year-ish of Zoom learning, I'm sure that really set kids back. So I'm not entirely surprised, but that doesn't mean it's not troubling to hear. So we really go over that. It was a fantastic conversation. I hope she comes back. I'm from a family of educators. So when I met her and heard her speak passionately about education and teaching children, I absolutely wanted her to be on the show, and you will not be disappointed. This is a phenomenal conversation. But before we get into it, got to thank my Patreon members, the ones that get the shout outs. There's Tracy Hughes, Cody Yaw, Zeke Thomas, Mariko. You guys are amazing. All of my Patreon people are amazing. You'll see this podcast in its video form, raw, unedited. You'll hear the before and after the audio podcast. You'll be able to see it on there. Got to thank Michael Kinsey, my editor, no relation, but he is a brother to me. I love you, man. You do amazing stuff for the show, and I truly appreciate you. And here's a special treat. So on my show, whether it's my solo show or conversation, I don't want these to really be one-sided. You don't have to just listen. I don't really want that. Sure, you know, people might argue that I like to hear myself speak. Agree to disagree on that. I am horrified when I hear my own voice. I feel like I need to apologize to everyone for how my voice actually sounds to them. But that said, I want to talk about these topics, and I want these to be a starting point for conversation. I want these to inspire further conversation, maybe even further interaction with me, whether you agree, disagree, have a perspective I've never heard before. I love that stuff. I want this podcast to inspire conversation and actual, true, healthy dialogue. That said, I got a wonderful email from a listener to me named Christine Gockerell. I'm so sorry if I butchered that last name, but she sent me an email and she said, "I love listening to you. I find myself saying F yeah out loud every time. After listening to a podcast, I went on a writing spree and just wanted to share. Thank you for the MFing Bible studies. You rock." I'm censoring it for this episode because this is about education, but you get the gist. So here's what she wrote. "To all you Christians, I have news for you. You are doing it all wrong. Do you want to be a Christian? Then be Christ-like. Have compassion and love for the downtrodden, the poor, the dirty, the ones who have made mistakes that left them in a bad place. Forgive and love. Help and accept. Talk, learn, and listen to people. Open your heart and mind and throw away the close-minded garbage you have come to accept. Don't just sit outside the box. Jump out of it and set it on fire. Forget the self-righteous, egotistical filth you have been taught and be what Jesus wanted you to be. Remember the woman at the well? She was a social outcast. People did not accept her. Our Savior Jesus Christ himself was drawn to her. He showed her love and acceptance when no one else did. He died on the cross to save you and me from our sins. The least you can do is follow his example. Thank you so much for that, Christine. And I couldn't agree more. Those Bible study lessons that she's talking about, those are on my TikTok channel where I break down specific Bible verses that have been purposely misused and misinterpreted to push hate and anger and intolerance and to use the Bible to thump people instead of using the Bible to be inspired to love other people, to learn how to be a better human being. So I love what you wrote, Christine. Thank you so much for that. And everyone else who's reached out talking about, you know, certain episodes of the podcast or having different thoughts, I genuinely appreciate what you guys say. And I say, keep it coming. But for now, without further ado, Jacqueline Davis. All right. Well, thank you so much for being on my show today, Jacqueline. I really am excited to have you here.
Well, I appreciate being able to be here with you, and I really appreciate the diverse topics that you cover in your podcast and all the information you bring to us.
Well, thank you. That means a lot coming from an educator such as yourself, and that's how we met. So we'll plug it at the end. I'll have it in the show notes so people can go and pledge for this really interesting and fun way of learning a Kickstarter campaign. But that's how we met, where you have this really cool learning Kickstarter game. And then we just, you and I, because I come from a family of educators, you know, you're an educator. We really talked about that and, you know, your thoughts on education and things are important. And I just had to have you on the show. So I'm really happy that you're here.
That's so sweet. Thank you.
Yeah. So yeah, we can just kind of dive into it. One of the things that I find is that's interesting is I feel in this country, I feel there that the current climate isn't all that great when it comes to education. I shouldn't say when it comes to that practice of educating, but there's some negative perceptions being put out there, completely false perceptions about education and teachers and all that stuff. Now my mom's been retired for a while, and the state I'm in, or my family's from Michigan, at least certain areas are very conservative. But like, in your experience, how have teachers responded to that? Where, I mean, already they're underpaid, overworked, and now they're being demonized when they're just trying to enlighten children and help them. Like, is the feeling about that?
Yeah, we've had a pretty big burnout rate and we've had a lot of attrition. And it's already a profession that asks a lot of people. It's not just educate the child in front of you and all sort of 20 to 30 of them in front of you, but it's also, you know, build them up socially, emotionally, teach them how to interact with their peers, teach them civics, teach them how to engage in the world as a great human being. Just a huge number of things that we expect schools and teachers to do for our children. And they have already a really tough job. And then the disruption in our schools through COVID, and overnight having to have them change from a classroom that they knew and a teaching style that they were familiar with and comfortable with to online learning was an enormous lift. And then when they went back, it was an even more enormous lift because the students were so far behind, and they were far behind in many ways, socially, emotionally, in terms of development, behind academically, severely behind academically. And also some of the trust with schools was breached. You know, parents didn't feel like schools were that reliable anymore, and kids felt sort of disconnected. So there was a lot of repair that had to be done. And again, we turned to our teachers to do all this lift. And so I think teachers are having unprecedented burnout in a profession that's always been difficult, that's always been underpaid. And we need to be even more grateful for these, you know, really frontline servants. You know, they talk about the firefighters and the medics and the hospitals and the nurses, all of whom, of course, are heroes. But our teachers and our principals are heroes, too. They have been on the front line and they have carried through an extremely difficult point in our history.
Yeah, it just... it's frustrating because you do have teachers who are really putting everything out there and wanting to enlighten kids' lives and educate them to be functioning members of society. And it just, it feels like, you know, society, the government, school boards, like it just, it seems like the pressure just keeps getting more and more on teachers in a way where it's almost setting them up to fail. And I don't know why people aren't really rallying around teachers, because it's weird. It's like people fought so hard against teaching virtually. They're like, our kids should be in school. And I get it, because not all of us can afford to work along with taking care of kids here. And also Zoom learning isn't exactly the most beneficial. Like we talked about before, if I'm not actively engaged in a conversation on Zoom and the meeting's over like 30, 45 minutes, my brain goes elsewhere, even if I don't intend. So I can't even imagine little kids, but that just, and then once they finally go back to school, now people are making accusations about teachers just for wanting to either teach or just be tolerant, teaching, like being supportive of alternative, I don't want to say alternative lifestyles, but unconventional, un-cis, normative, whatever. And it just, it feels like a no-win situation for teachers.
Well, I think in general, so much in this country is being polarized right now. You know, so much is ideological and so much is on both extremes, but particularly, you know, in one direction, pretty extreme. And so I think what is happening is those political battles are being played out on every battlefield that people can find. And classrooms and schools are just another battlefield where adults feel like they can play out their ideological interest and differences. And it's really hard because teachers are really basically trying to teach kids math, social studies, science, reading, writing, you know, and so they choose a few books that not everyone loves, or they choose, you know, some kind of curriculum. What we need is them to be focused on teaching kids all the core subjects. And I think another thing that's happening in our country is we have an enormous literacy crisis, shocking literacy crisis. And there's different reasons why we have that. One reason is that in our schools of education that prepare elementary school teachers to be hopefully effective, many of them, the majority of them, still don't teach elementary school teachers how to teach reading according to what we know about the science of how a child's brain learns to read. So even that setting up our teachers, you know, we're sending teachers into elementary schools with expectations that they can do their job, and yet we haven't prepared them to do probably the most basic thing that they need to do, which is to teach kids to read. And we say in the education world, children learn to read until third grade. And then after third grade, they read to learn. And so let me make that concrete. Yeah, let me make that concrete, because it's sort of like, okay, what do you mean by that? What I mean by that is up until third grade, they're learning to read. They're being taught the structure of reading, syntax, how do you sound out words? How do you learn the alphabet? Like all that is what they should be being taught until third grade. So they are learning to read. It's the core focus. It doesn't mean we're, you know, abandoning math and other incredibly important subjects. It just means they have to learn to read.
Yeah.
And then what we say is at fourth grade, they read to learn. And so let me give you a couple examples. Math problems, written math problems, critically important for children. But they can't do a written math problem and understand it if they can't read. Science. They're getting science experiments. They're getting hypothesis worksheets that they're supposed to fill out. If they can't read the experiment or the instructions, they can't do it. They're in theater, they're in drama, they get the script. If they can't read, they can't do it. And so, you know, it goes on and on and on. Yeah. But when we make this shift to fourth grade, where we're no longer actively teaching reading, but instead we are expecting children to read to learn, we're in trouble if kids can't read. And 70% of American children don't read at grade level by fourth grade. And it's even worse among low-income children. 82% of African-American children in our country don't read at grade level by fourth grade. That's more than 8 in 10. And so part of what I feel like what's happening in this country is our reading scores are even worse than they've ever been. We just lost 3 decades of progress with the setbacks from COVID, and we are in really dire straits. And so now we have teachers that are already overwhelmed, already overtaxed, overburdened. We didn't train them well when they were in their teacher prep programs to do this, to learn how, you know, to know how to teach children to read. Now we're expecting them to close the gap on these horrible scores and bring us back out of this mess. Sure. And by the way, their curriculum that they're getting, 60% of American schools are still using curriculum that's basically discredited and not aligned to the brain science of reading. So here's the teacher who hasn't been trained to teach reading. And I'm just giving this as a really powerful example of like how tough this is for teachers. So they haven't been trained to teach the most basic thing, which is how kids learn to read. They end up with a curriculum that doesn't support that. And then the professional development they're getting isn't building their capacity to teach kids to read based on the science of reading. So it's almost like a triple whammy, right? They're not getting the right PD. They're not getting the right curriculum. They're not getting the right prep. And then we say, hey, it's on you. These scores are horrible. Make sure all of our kids can read. Figure it out at the classroom level. And so those are the, you know, that's one of the many ways, you know, in a concrete example, why our teachers are feeling so burned out and so exhausted, because they're expected to close these gaps. They're expected to change this horrible trajectory. And yet we sort of tie their hands behind their back and their feet and say, okay, you don't have resources. You haven't been trained. You haven't been prepared, but go make it happen. And that's a recipe for total frustration and real deflation and demoralization.
Yeah. It's like giving someone a set of silverware and being like, build me a pyramid. Like, it's not going to go well, you know, it's crazy. And I just, you know, where, I mean, maybe you don't know the answer to this, because I mean, if you did, maybe you'd be way up there solving all of our nation's problems, but like, where does that come from? Where the curriculum, like, why is it where the curriculum is so regressive, but pushed so hard? When, like you were saying, studies are showing this is not how kids learn. Like, where does that come from? Yeah.
So it's really interesting. Emily Hanford has a brand new series podcast that is called Soul the Story. And I highly encourage anyone who really wants the depth of that question answered. And it's stunning and it's maddening, really. But what we know, even what I knew even before this amazing podcast, but it's just been reinforced, is that in our country, there have been sort of these education heroes. And there's one named Sue Pinnell, and there's another one called Lucy Calkins. And these people, I'm sure, so well-intentioned, but they have promulgated theories about how children learn to read that are actually just not scientifically correct. Mm. What's challenging, it's one thing to understand why 25 years ago, before we had all the, you know, neuroscientists and cognitive scientists and MRIs to teach us, it's understandable that there were many people guessing. There were many people making hypotheses and trying to figure it out, right? Because none of us knew. And so everyone was kind of getting their best swing at the ball, hoping that we got as close to possible. And, you know, studying kids and watching kids and trying to figure out the hypothesis. What's problematic is two of these leaders, Sue Pinnell and Lucy Calkins, became real rock stars in the world of education and in the world of teaching reading. But when all this science started coming out 25 years ago, and even Congress commissioned the National Reading Panel in 2000, they very clearly said, this is what we know about kids' brains. And there's 200 plus studies that we now have. And this is what kids need to know. Even then, with all that evidence, they didn't change course. And so now we have a situation where many school districts across America, and the majority, are still using those curriculums that they've been trained on, they've paid money for, they've spent years integrating into their systems and their schools. And now we're finding out, hey, they don't work. And so very tragically, schools and these leading, you know, these nationally known educators did not pivot as fast as they absolutely should have. And in my book, it's malpractice, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, 70% of American children don't read at grade level. And
that's staggering.
Yeah, it's unbelievable when you look at the data and you realize what's going on. And only 20% of them are dyslexic, right? So you can't wrap it
yeah,
up.
Yeah, you say, can't oh, really blame it on learning disabilities.
Or, oh, all these kids have learning difference and that's why. No. And in fact, the cognitive scientists say all but 5%, 95% of children should be able to read at grade level by fourth grade. They're cognitively able to do it. So we should have 5% not reading at grade level, but instead we have 70%. Yeah. And I think that's a burnout for everybody, right? It's exhausting as a parent to try to support your child or a family member.
For real, it really is.
It's exhausting for the kid, right? I mean, the kid that can't read, I know, because my son was one of them. They struggle so much. It's deflating. It ruins their self-esteem. It's demoralizing. And so that's the kid. And then the teacher who's struggling trying to help a kid but has all the wrong tools and has been trained in all the wrong ways, they're frustrated too. There was a great story recently I heard, wonderful story about this teacher in Washington, D.C. And she taught first grade and she was at a very low-income school. And she said, you know, year after year, I would have the majority of my kids unable to read. And I initially thought it was them. Something's wrong with them. And then eventually I started to say, no, there's can't be something wrong with them. There's too many of them to have it be something wrong with them. There must be something wrong with me and my teaching. But I had no idea what to do differently. And I was so frustrated that I was ready to quit. I just wanted to like throw in the towel and quit and go get some other kind of job because I just couldn't take it anymore because I came to this profession to help kids and I was failing them and I was failing them every year. And so she went through this year-long, very intensive science of reading training. And the next year she implemented and she said, 95% of my children are where they need to be at the end of first grade. They're tracking to where they need to be. And that's because I know how to teach and I now have the resources to do it. And she said, and so now I'm not going to quit. I'm going to stay and I'm going to make this magic for kids. So that's what we need our teachers. We need them to have the skills. We need them to have the training and we need them to have the curriculums that actually support what we know about brain science and how children learn. And that goes for math and reading. I'm particularly focused on reading. But if we want our teachers to stay in classrooms, we've got to support them in a lot of ways. And that's one of the most important ways.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, just looking at even the on the national side, it seems like the support just really isn't there. I mean, yeah, Betsy DeVos was a terrible choice for Secretary of Education. She's from Michigan. So even Michigan Republicans were like, oh no, when she was put in that position. But even going back like to No Child Left Behind, that was incredibly regressive for education. And it just seems like, you know, even going like school vouchers, like school choice, that stuff, all that does is for the families that aren't impoverished, taking that tax money away from that school. So then there's even less support at the school that they were taken out of. It seems like this uphill battle, but you know, with like what you're talking about and how she was able to implement that, like what are those new developments that are helping teachers be able to better teach and better educate their students? Yeah.
Well, some of our teacher training programs, right? The programs, the graduate schools and the undergraduates that prepare our teachers across the country, some of them are starting to change. And so we have a local American university here that has really pivoted under an amazing dean of education who has been very focused on changing. She came in, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago, and her whole focus has been changing the way their principals and their teachers that go through their program get prepared. And she's focused on teaching elementary school teachers how to teach reading based on the science. And she's focused on training principals on actually knowing how to really lead and really manage and knowing instruction so they can coach teachers. Because if teachers are all by themselves and unsupported, they're not going to feel very good and they're not going to want to stay.
Absolutely.
But if the principal understands what it means to instruct, they understand teaching, they understand learning, they can coach their teachers, they can support their teachers, they can develop their teachers, the teachers feel a lot better about their jobs. So I think one thing that we really need to have happen is we need the higher ed institutions that are preparing our teachers and our principals to prepare them with what we know actually works now, and not to be caught up in old school models, not to be caught up in, you know, I got tenure and this is my little special thing I love to teach, and I'm just going to keep teaching it till I, you know, retire, when it has nothing to do with what we need to be taught as like a coherent program for teachers. It can't be a hodgepodge of these random classes they take. Mm-hmm. It needs to be a coherent program of study. So I think that's one really important thing that needs to change. Higher ed needs to change, and they need to be accountable to schools and their students to get them ready to do a job that is already incredibly difficult. You know, I think we absolutely need to pay teachers better in this country. Yeah. I mean, it's insane. We need teachers. They're on the front line. It is the most important job probably in the world, except for being a parent or a family member raising a child, right? Teachers are there. They're raising our next generation. And so we need to pay them so that they have livable wages and they can stay in the profession. Again and again and again, I talk to people who leave, not because they don't want to teach, not because they're burned out, but because they literally can't live on the wages that they get, and they can't get a house. They can't, you know, pay their doctor's bill. I mean, it's basic. And so we have to pay teachers better. We were really fortunate a couple of years ago in DC, where one of our superintendents, called a chancellor here, significantly increased pay. And it's been a huge help. It's attracted better people to the profession. It's retained high quality people because they can live on the wage. It's still not easy, but it is a far higher wage than many other places. But you ask, you know, kind of what else can happen. I think states have a role to play too. I think states shouldn't accredit higher ed institutions that train teachers that don't train elementary school teachers to teach reading, right? Like, why should they accredit them? States decide how teachers get certified. I don't think you should certify teachers that don't know how to teach reading. So I think there's a set of kind of levers we can play, and there are a bunch of actors that can do better. I think No Child Left Behind is interesting because, you know, you mention it, there are some really good aspects of it. And I'm a Democrat, so, you know, but I can say there are some really good aspects of No Child Left Behind. One of them is that it forced the disaggregation of data. And so
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah. So for the first time as a country, we were required to pull the data apart by segments. How are African-American children doing in this school? How are Caucasian children doing? How are Latino doing? How are children with individual education plans, special ed, learning differences? How are they doing? How are children that are affluent doing? How are middle income? How are low income children doing? And it was really the first time as a nation, we had a giant wake up call of like, wow, we have kids all over the country not doing well, regardless of anything, regardless of background, regardless of socioeconomic. We have kids in every single way you cut this data that are not doing well. But we also saw that our low income children were doing dramatically lower, you know, in terms of performance than our upper income children were. And that's not because they're not smart. That's because we as adults haven't provided equitable education, excellent schools and teachers for every child and the resources. So it has nothing to do with children. It has everything to do with the adults and how we organize ourselves. So, you know, that was actually a really good thing. It was really good to force us all as a country to say, let's look at the kids with individual improvement plan, educational plans. And let's look at the children who have learning differences. How are they doing? In Washington, D.C., only 8% of our children with the individual education plan learning differences read at grade level? 8%. So 92% don't, right? And so overall, we've got 70% not doing it. But children with IEPs with learning differences is 92% in this city. And it's similar across the country. So it was important for us to see that data and begin to ask questions. The other thing is that there was a really strong focus with No Child Left Behind on the science of reading and on focusing on the things that we know works. And this is where your beginning question about partisanship and ideology actually played out in kind of a negative way, is that there were a lot of teachers that said, you know, I'm a Democrat and I'm not adopting anything coming out of this White House. And so, you know, I think we all have to be really careful that we look at evidence, we look at facts, and we make our own judgments, and we look at studies and research, and we don't just dismiss based on sort of political ideology, and particularly now when the country is so divided.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely a huge issue. I mean, we see that all the time where people vote against their own best interests, you know, just because it's from them. Or, you know, we see bills either way. We see bills not being passed because we don't want to give that party a win. And it's the people who suffer are the non-politicians, the ones who those bills and those and the kids. Yeah, the ones those bills actually are supposed to affect. You know, what do we have? So, yeah, you shouldn't just discount it just because it was from W. Like, you know, even, okay, say what you will about the guy, but maybe this is one of those situations where a broken clock is right twice, you know, like maybe this would actually be beneficial, even if you don't like the guy, you know, there's too much of that. And I'm a little, I am nervous, you know, when you say like giving it back to the state, it makes me a little nervous for those states run by people who don't listen to education or facts. Like that's like I get what you're saying, and I completely I'm all for it. It just makes me nervous for those people that reject facts.
Well, no, so I just want to clarify, I actually wish we had a more national system of education. Yeah. I wish we actually figured out more at a national level and made sure all kids, regardless of where they live, had equitable opportunity and equitable support. I wish all kids had the same funding formula. So I don't actually love that states have so much power. And right now they still have so much power. And so while they have so much power, they should be using that power in ways that help drive education forward and help make sure all children are going to learn at a high level. And so they still have the magic wand. And so they need to use their magic wand well. I do wish from a national standpoint, we would get more equity. You know, it's not fair that the funding formula in California is roughly $5,000 a child. That's all the money they get for a child. Whereas in New Jersey, it's something like $14,000 per child. And so that's just baked in inequity. How can you expect a school district or a school to educate the same when you're getting $5,000 per child versus getting $14,000 per child? And those are all decisions that are either state-based or locally district-based, regionally based. And so there's just enormous inequity across the country. In some states where it's regionally based, you have one neck of the woods with, you know, $10,000 per kid, and you drive 7 miles and it's $3,000 per kid. So that's just inherently inequitable. And we can't expect that the kids are going to turn out with the same you know, outcomes. Like, we've baked in a way for them not to come out the same outcomes. So those are things that really have to be addressed. And I wish they could be addressed at the federal level. I wish we could say to states, you know, no, you can't fund at this low, low level. This is the minimum that everybody has to do. We have a national minimum wage. It may still be too low, but we have it. We have a floor. Yeah. It would be great if we said, yeah, there's a floor. You cannot go below this in terms of funding each child for their education.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I didn't even know that. That disparity is shocking. You know, that is kind of at a loss for words here, because that's such a stark difference between the two. And you can't expect the kids to turn out exactly the same when it comes to being on the educated side. So, you know, you were talking about there's now more science and more endeavors to improve the education of children. I mean, can you maybe go over some of like the science or some of like what we've learned, absolutely. Whether or not it's being implemented quite yet? Like,
yeah,
what we've
absolutely. Learned about education. No, we're fortunate. We actually know a lot. And so I'll talk about the neurotypical child, a child that doesn't have learning differences. And then I'll actually talk a little bit about the child that does have learning differences, because we know a lot about both now. So the average child, the overwhelming majority of the average child without learning differences and challenges needs a program of learning to read that begins with what we call the alphabetic principle. Pretty fancy for something really simple. It literally means letter sound correspondence. You know, A makes A, right? But very ironic, or very interestingly, we often show kids the letter A with an airplane. That's not A. That's not the sound that A makes and that A makes. It's air, airplane. So in that case, that A is actually making an air sound, not an ah sound like apple. So we often get it wrong from the very beginning. You know, we're teaching the kid the letter A. We're teaching them its name, because it the beginning is just a symbol, right? It's just some random symbol that it happens to be an A, and we happen to call an A, and it has a sound for an A. And so that's the very beginning. We have to teach children that, and we have to get them to know the sound and how it corresponds to these like hieroglyphics that happen to be the letters of the English language, right?
Yeah.
And then the next thing we have to teach them is phonemic awareness. And that's all these sound patterns. And then we have to move on to phonics, and we have to teach them the rules of this crazy code of English, right? We have to teach them, you know, if you have an E and it comes after a consonant like N, and the letter before is a vowel, that E is going to make that vowel say its name. But then, of course, there are all the ways in which English doesn't follow the rules. And you teach kids this, and then they still have to learn how to kind of move beyond what they thought was the rule, because English sometimes breaks the rule. But we know that the neural pathways. So what we know is that you can learn to speak. In fact, every child learns to speak and understands oral language by their home environment. So if you're growing up in a household where one parent speaks Spanish and another parent speaks English, and they speak to you in those languages, you will automatically grow up being bilingual. You will come out, you know, by 7 years old with two languages, because that's what you've been hearing. And sure. So that's a natural adoption process. Learning to read is not natural. It is actually a really complex neural process, where all these neural pathways have to come together. Five different parts of the brain have to come together and work together. And those neural pathways start being laid when you're a tiny infant, before you're even 24 months, the beginning is happening. And so we know a lot about the science behind how children learn to read. And so we know what's needed, and we know now what we should all be doing. Now, for children that are learning difference, particularly dyslexic children, there are these parts of the brain that have to come together, as I mentioned, to read. And for a dyslexic child, in the back of their brain, there's two key parts: the part that helps you learn to decode, which is a fancy word for sounding out words, and the part of the brain that helps you with fluency, which is the speed and the ease at which you read. And so those two parts of the dyslexic brain are what we call inactive, or not yet activated, or kind of dormant. That's the way to think about it. But what we also know about the brain is it has a ton of plasticity. And so when we understand that dyslexia is not a permanent condition, you're going to forever not have your left finger. It's permanent. It's never coming back. It's fixed, right? That's not the brain. And for a dyslexic kid, with the right support, with a ton of practice and the right intervention, they too can learn absolutely to read at grade level. and they can read effectively. And my son's a perfect example of that. And so since we know that and we see it, we should be doing it. Now, dyslexic children may never be as good of a speller as a kid that's not dyslexic. But frankly, I'm not dyslexic and I'm a terrible speller and I use spell check all the time. And they may never read at the same speed and with the same ease and fluency that a kid that is not dyslexic, but they absolutely can read at grade level. And my son's a perfect example of that. And we pulled him out of two different schools because they were not using curriculums based on the science of reading. And the elementary school teachers didn't know how to teach reading. And we moved him to a school where it's all science of reading. And the teachers are amazing and they know how to teach. And so he started second grade 1.8 years behind. The school took total responsibility. They pulled him out of class three times a week for one-on-one tutoring with the reading specialist. They kept us surprised. They kept us up to date with how he was progressing. And he ended third grade 2 years later on grade level. And he sat this morning and read the New York Times to us, the headings, not the articles. he picked up the New York Times and he literally read us all the headings. And he was engaged. He was interested. He wanted to read it. He's not yet at a point where he can read the fine print of the New York Times, but he can read like a paragraph or so.
Well, I know a lot of adults that can't do that with the New York Times either. Right. So no worries for your son. He has time.
So it's, you know, now that I've seen it firsthand and I've seen what a great school can do, I just want it for all kids. I want every kid to have that. And so the games that I'm making as part of Clever Noodle, Clever Noodle is a seriously fun, surprisingly educational tabletop game company. And it's all about creating games to help children on their reading journey so that children want to practice more, so that it is fun, so that they are engaged. And so as my son said one day after I was making game after game, he said, "Mom, I know what you're doing." And I said, "Oh, really? What?" He said, "You're teaching me to read, but it's okay because it's really fun. So we can keep going." I thought, okay, yeah, he's on to me.
That's hilarious.
He's on to me. He's a savvy kid and he knows what's going on, but he didn't mind it because he had fun and he was enjoying the games. And so he's willing. So he practiced a lot because we played the games a lot. And his teacher said, "You know, what are you doing? This is really helping whatever you're reinforcing at home." And I said, "You know, I'm playing games with him all the time in different games based on where he is and what he needs to learn next." And it really had an impact. And so his teacher said, "You need to share these with more kids. You need to help more kids." And I thought, no way. I have no idea how to do that. So it's been 2 years and it's been a journey up and down. I thought last spring we were done because we could not solve the manufacturing issue with all the supply chain problems. Yeah, oof. And then we finally figured it out this summer and we didn't give up and we're back in it. And now we're on Kickstarter and we just got enough funding to fund our first 2000 games and put them into manufacturing. So it's really exciting. And every day is kind of different, right? And there are days where I'm like, we're definitely going to do this. We're going to get all these games into the hands of kids and homes and classrooms across America and across the globe. And then there are days where I'm like, okay, this is insane. This is never happening. But most days I still feel really hopeful.
Yeah, creating something new from scratch basically is pretty daunting when, you know, you get into it knowing that there's all these little details and then you get into it like, oh, there are more little details than I thought there were going to be. So wait, so you a couple years ago, you came up with the game idea just to help your son?
Exactly.
Oh, that, wow.
I was
okay.
Desperate.
No, that's COVID. Amazing.
No, it was COVID. I had to take a pause from work to be at home with him all day. And within about, I don't know, a week of COVID, he walked up and I said, "Okay, you know, your class is starting. Let's sit down on the couch." And he walked up to my laptop and he closed the screen. And he said, "I'm not doing this. I'm not doing any more online." And later we came to understand, you know, it was his dyslexia and his ADHD that really made it untenable for him. And he just said, "I'm not doing it." And I was sort of like, well, okay, well, what are we going to do now? And so I tried for a while to convince him that he needed to get back on screen. And he was pretty adamant. He wasn't doing it. And so I was pretty desperate. And I called the teacher and I said, "Look, you know, just at this point, give me the learning objectives. Tell me what he needs to learn." And Yeah, unfortunately, I taught high school and not elementary. And unfortunately, I helped lead a high school, not an elementary. But I have a lot of friends who are teachers. I know, thank goodness, a lot of people who understand literacy and learning to read. I'm going to start calling people and I'm going to ask them, what do I read online? What books do I buy? How do I figure this out? And really quickly, because I don't have a lot of time to spare right now. And I've got a kid in front of me who's not learning much. He would still go online sometimes for math because he really loved math and he's actually quite good at math. But the reading and the writing, absolutely not. He refused. So I started just with soccer. You know, he loves soccer. So I started taking him out in the backyard and, you know, doing different pieces of the learn to read journey. And basically, if he would learn a word, then he could, you know, kick the soccer ball. And his teacher did what so many teachers do in first and second grade, which is basically send home a long list of what they call high frequency sight words. And I'll explain that in a minute. But, you know, anybody that's got a kid has gotten probably in first or second grade, I bet everybody, the list, right? The sight word list, teach your kids. And sometimes they come home with a packet of flashcards and it's like, you know, drill and kill these into your kid's brain. Well, it's just not very fun. And frankly, it's not very effective. And so, you know, our teacher sent home the list, the one page list that had 220 words on it and these tiny print and tiny rows and columns. And I thought, well, this is, I can't hand him this. And so I started even reading, like, how do you teach this to kids? And then that was what one of the first games was. It was a game to help him learn these high frequency sight words. So high frequency sight words are words that appear, the high frequency are words that appear very often in early children's literature. And they still can sound out most of those words, and they should learn to sound out most of those words. And as they read them more and more and more often and get used to them and get used to sounding them out, eventually we want this fancy thing to happen where they do what's called orthographic mapping to their brain, which is basically just their brain remembers it, right? And so when they practice it more and more and more, they learn it. And then they can read it more quickly when they're reading a book and they don't have to stop at every word and sound it out, which makes it so choppy. You have no idea what you just read. And there's actually a correlation between how well children comprehend what they read and how well they read it. Because if you stop nine times in a sentence and have to sound out the word, by the time you get to the period or the exclamation point, you have no idea what you just read. You have to go back and read it again and again. So the high frequency words are really important because they give kids kind of a set, basically, of words that they become so familiar with, they can read a little bit faster when they see those words. It gives them sort of anchors. And then the sight words are words that they actually have to memorize because this set, smaller set, very small set, still a set, are words that don't follow the rules. They're not phonetically able to be sounded
out.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And for that word, you actually have to see it. And like when you have the sight of it, you have to know it. And the example I always give, because it makes it really clear. So the phonetic rule for the word done, D-O-N-E, if you follow the rule, it's done.
Yeah, it's not. That's true.
It's done.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? And the same thing for the word some, not S-U-M, which is some, that makes exact sense, but some, S-O-M-E. So if you understand the rules of phonics, that is some, but it's not some, it's some. So those are the kinds of words where kids can't sound them out because if they follow all the rules, yeah, they'll get it wrong. So they have to memorize it. And that's, again, it's not a huge set of those, but there are those. So what we do in this game is we have over 300 of these high frequency and sight words to help children learn from really four all the way until nine. And some kids will learn it little bit later, it will be five or six, and some kids will learn it so quickly that they'll be done with it by seven. So it's a range, right? And every kid develops a little bit differently in a different pace. But the cards that they have in this game, which is basically a hop along a path to the pizza, and if you get to the pizza, you win, and they're little kangaroos hopping along. And so when you hop along to get to move forward, you draw a card. And on those cards are all the 300 plus high frequency sight words. And if the word is in black, it says to the kid, hey, it's black, sound this one out. You're going to be able to sound it out and then keep practicing it until you really learn it. Ooh, this one's in red. It breaks the rules. Stop. you're going to have to memorize it. And so it's an embedded tool that helps kids use their best skills. You know, they're going to sound out when they absolutely should be, and they're going to practice that sounding out. And when they can't, we don't want them struggling, thinking, okay, I'm going to keep trying to sound this out, and it doesn't work. Like, no, this one doesn't work. So you're going to have to memorize it. And then the other thing we've done that will help all children, but particularly help children who are dyslexic, is we've embedded all the multisensory actions. So in a card, they're little kangaroo actions. And so the kangaroo stomps its feet. And so the kangaroo is going to spell the word the or the, two different pronunciations, but the word the, or maybe I should use that. The kangaroo is going to spell that. And there's a picture of a kangaroo foot stomping. And so the kid says, okay, the first stomp will be that. You say the word. The second, third, and the second, third, and fourth stomp are T-H-A-T, 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 and then the final stomp, that. And so they're actually physically working through these words and helping imprint it. And so that's really important for dyslexic kids. But frankly, it makes it way more fun for all the kids because they're drawing a word with their tail, their kangaroo tail, which happens to be their tush, and they think it's hilarious. They're drawing a word in the air with their nose, spelling it out and spelling it again and making the letters, which is wiring it into their body and their brain. And yet it's hilarious and it's silly. And so the kids are laughing and having a good time. And so there's two ways to play the game. It's called Kangaroo Cravings. And kids can play it cooperatively so that if they're still just learning and it would be a little bit stressful to be competitive, the kangaroos get to play as a team against the raccoon, or they can play it competitively where kangaroos play against kangaroos and they race together toward the pizza. And so it's a basic board game. It has some of the features of other basic board games, a couple of different popular ones embedded in it. You know, there's spaces where something silly happens and you have to go back, and there's spaces where something great happens and you get to go forward. It's very colorful. It's been done by an amazing children's book illustrator who has made it very, very enticing and attractive for kids. And they really love the board and they're racing to a pizza. Like, what kid doesn't love pizza?
Yeah.
So it's fun and they really enjoy it. We've play tested with over 100 children and watched them play it and made a lot of changes based on the gameplay and
that's great.
Engaged them. And then done it with tested with a lot of experts, literacy experts and teachers, and made a lot of changes as well on the efficacy, on the real science of reading. Will this for sure be effective for children?
That's amazing. And it's called Kangaroo Cravings?
It's called Kangaroo Cravings because the kangaroos have a craving to eat that pizza.
And I think you're onto something, because if I was any political person, one of the bills I would pass is to subsidize Pizza Hut to do those personal pan pizzas. Because let me tell you, as a kid from the 90s, that was very... very persuasive in reading books, because if you read so many, you get a free personal pan pizza from Pizza Hut back in the day. Oh, that's
a great idea. Well, there's a local pizza place in DC that's amazing. It's absolutely delicious. It's called Comet Ping Pong, because you can go and not only eat your pizza, you can play ping pong in the back room. And kids love it. And as adults, we love it because it's really good pizza. And they've been a wonderful partner. They've been passing out our bookmarks to families to tell them about our game and our opportunity. But they also hosted and gave us a really amazing launch party. And the best part of that launch party is, yes, we had a lot of adults and a lot of adults who were supportive, and it was really wonderful. And we had amazing pizza, which was great, but we had a lot more kids show up than I expected. And so we had the game set up at 9 different tables. And so it was so much fun. The kids were sitting there playing the game, laughing, enjoying themselves, teasing each other. Some parents were helping. Some parents were able to walk around and eat their own pizza and ignore the kids because they were doing so well on their own. And you have these kids sitting around eating pizza that they really love and playing the game. So it was a beautiful sight. And there were a lot of kids there. So again, we got to game test a woman who leads a really big dyslexia training center. I greeted her and was so excited that she came to the party. And, you know, I was introducing her to adults, and she said, you know, excuse me, I really appreciate the introductions, but I actually just want to go watch all these kids play because I want to see how this really works. Mm-hmm. And so she walked around the rest of the evening and watched kids play. And then at the end, she came and I was so grateful. She said, this works. and I want to buy a bunch for my summer program because I want all the kids that are in my summer program to have chances to play games and have fun. And this is great. And I know it's fun, but I also know it works. So that was, you know, one of the best votes of confidence you could ever get. I was so happy and thankful. But the kids loved it. And that's what we want to see. We want to see kids having fun while they're learning.
Yep.
And hopefully they won't be as savvy as my son to know what to
do. They won't be onto it. Like, oh, they won't you're be trying onto it. To
Mom, trick me I know what you're doing. You're teaching me to read. They won't be onto us.
That is so funny. So when this episode comes out, there will be about 2 weeks left of the campaign. So it comes out on Tuesday. But for those of you listening, don't wait. Don't wait until the last minute because life is busy. You might just straight up forget. So let's support a game and a company that is just doing their best to produce functioning members of society, future functioning members of society, because this stuff is huge. And I know like parents struggle with finding ways to help teach their kid because they of them didn't go to school for education. And there's some for some reason this new math because the other math wasn't hard enough.
I now can't work with my child for math either. Oh my God. Wow. Like, what is this?
I have never been so resentful over rectangles in my life until this new math. But that said, like, yes, people out there listening, it will be in the show notes for the link for this, but this is an amazing Kickstarter campaign that I wish nothing but the most success for this and all your future games. Hopefully you'll come back and talk about those when the time is right. But is there anything else that you want to leave listeners with?
Yes, I would say, you know, everything you said, double down, please join us. You just go to our website, www.clevernoodle.com. And on it, there's a button that says order the game. And that's to order Kangaroo Cravings. You can literally click the button and it takes you through everything. Some people are new to Kickstarter. It is a Kickstarter campaign. And so for some that are new, it's a little tricky. You have to scroll down and pick a pledge level. Or you can go to the very top and just say pledge without a reward and put the dollar amount in that you want to give. And honestly, a dollar helps. $5 helps. You know, every single person can help make these games a reality and help provide more tools for our children in homes and classrooms across the country to help them learn to read and to support their reading journey. So you just go to the website, www.clevernoodle.com, and you click on the button that says order the game. And if you want to go direct to Kickstarter, you can do that as well. And you just put in Kangaroo Cravings and it comes up. So every backer helps. Every backer improves our ability to manufacture more. So we did meet the campaign goal, which lets us manufacture a minimum of 2,000 games, which we had to meet in order to go to manufacturing. But every time we get $25 more, we manufacture one more game. And so the more games we can manufacture, the more kids get helped. And the other thing is that we have two amazing charitable partners. So we talked a lot about equity earlier, and we're really committed to equity. We don't want this just to be in middle income and higher income schools that can afford to buy games. We don't want it to be in middle income and higher income families only that can afford to buy games. We want every kid to have access. And so we have two charitable partners that are wonderful. One will help us get the games into 15 different cities in low-income schools across those cities.
Oh, wow.
And the other partner will help us get them into low-income children's homes across the country. And so you can also go on to our Kickstarter and just plug in that you want to donate the games. And then they'll go to these kids in these schools that really need them so that we can all make sure we have kids that have equitable access. You can also just go to the top and make it really simple and say, pledge without a reward, stick in a dollar amount. And then we actually email you and say, hey, how do you want to use the, do you want to take some of the games yourself? Do you want to send them off to charity? What do you want to do? So we give you kind of another chance to tell us what you want if you want to make it really simple. So yes, we would appreciate all the support possible. And really, it's about the support and the dollar amount. Of course, give as much as you can. It helps us make more games. But a dollar is great. $5 is great. It all helps us.
I love
it. I think about I think about Bernie Sanders, and he wasn't raising big, giant dollars. He was getting $5 and $10 and $15. And with that, he raised millions of dollars. And so I think there's a path to do that. and if we get lots of people coming to join us. And so please, please do join us and help us bring yes. these games to life for more children and more games to life to really help kids across the whole reading journey.
Yes. Well, I completely agree and support that. And we're going to be pushing the heck out of this thing to try and get it in front of the most people. Well, Jacqueline, thank you so much for being on my show. I'm so honored that you came to talk about this and talk about education because it is such an important topic.
I thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate all you're doing to bring really great topics and ideas to us all, because gosh knows we all need to learn right now.
Well, thanks again. And thank you everyone for listening. All right, everybody. That was this week's episode of the Coffee Time Podcast with Noah Kinsey. So what did you think? Do you agree, disagree? Were there points I missed? Let me know what you think. In the show notes, there's links to all my social media accounts. Please comment, reply, message. I would love to hear your thoughts on this. And make sure to become a member of my Patreon. It's at www.patreon.com/Noah Kinsey. There's a lot of exclusive content. It's just a great place with a lot of fun perks and some fantastic discussion. This has been a production of iHeartRadio's Obscure Celebrity Network.